I'm Gene, and this is Perfect Flow. I'm a New Zealand-based athlete and coach focused on optimizing performance, health, and well-being. While I have a professional background in biomedical engineering, I've chosen to follow my more immediate passions for running, endurance, adventure, movement, nutrition, lifestyle, community, psychology, and personal growth. My goal in starting this podcast is to connect with bright minds to extract the information I need to live a life that makes sense and feels good, and share those conversations with others. Apart from your favorite podcast app, the best places to follow my work are perfectflow.nz, genebeverage.nz, and Perfect Flow on Facebook. Whoa, that was cool. That was a super frothy conversation with Vajin Armstrong that I've just recorded. And I'm really keen to release this one to you guys and see what you think about it. I loved it. And I really think that Vajin says the things that I'm thinking far more clearly and beautifully than how I could say them. So I just really want to get this podcast out. The things we talked about were the missing season of 2020, the experience of ultra running and endurance sports, the process focus. So process focus is my terminology, but it's really about focusing on the process behind sport and the way that we articulate that, I think, and the way he articulates that is really interesting. We also talk about coaching strategies and encouragement, purpose, reason, and calling. And then we get into meditation a bit, which is something we're both quite interested in. And I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Vajin, welcome to Perfect Flow. So it sounds like you also missed out on Ultra Trail Australia. That was supposed to be my kind of race earlier this year.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you going back next year?
Yeah, I would like to. I haven't run the 100 kilometer race there for a few years. And so I was really hoping to race this year. And obviously it just got cancelled. So it looks like no one will get to do it this year. But I'd love to go back. I mean, I'd love to be able to see the world traveling and having adventures and the larger communities getting connected, but we shall see.
Yeah. Was there any other races that you were keen to do that disappeared on you?
Yeah, well, I was going to go to Europe for several months and have that. I mean, I really love being over in Europe during the summertime and getting to experience the alpine areas when they're at their sunniest and there's the most wild flowers and the
alpine meadow.
Yeah, there's something really so beautiful cool. Because it's such a fleeting thing. It's like just at the moment it's springtime here in New Zealand, and so seeing all the spring blossoms and the magnolias and the daffodils out, and the fact that they are only out for such a short period of time gives them a certain beauty and poignancy that you know that in a few weeks they're going to be gone.
Is that the cherry blossoms that you guys have here?
Yeah,
in Christchurch? Because I've never really seen them in Auckland. So
yeah.
Walking around the past week, I've been like, whoa, these are really cool.
Yeah, so there's quite a lot of Japanese cherry blossoms here. Okay. So yeah, the Japanese know them as sakura. And in Japan, it's a huge pastime. Every spring, it's a huge event when the cherry blossoms start and people come out in the absolute thousands to spend time just sitting underneath the blossoms and appreciating them.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. Yeah, it definitely feels like spring has arrived.
Yeah.
The past few weeks, although we did have some snow in Castle Hill. Are you up that way often for training out in Castle Hill towards Arthur's Pass?
Yeah, over the summer months, I definitely try and get up there hopefully every few weeks. And I mean, we've got just some amazing terrain up there. But I also do a lot of training just relatively close to Christchurch. We've got Banks Peninsula, which is in another amazing playground with just heaps of beautiful bays and incredibly remote. Like some of the bays out there, you get there and you feel like you're really on the far edge of the earth, and I really love that feeling of solitude that you get in some of the areas on Banks Peninsula as well. So
Is there much vehicle access to some of those places, or are you running down like access roads and stuff?
Yeah, it's mainly there's a lot of dirt roads that go all over the peninsula there, and there's a few trails, and if you know where to look, there's some good trails. Yeah. And there's heaps of steep climbing. So it's Banks Peninsula, for those of you who don't know what it is, it's the peninsula that juts out next to Christchurch. And it was two extinct volcanoes that that over the years have sort of eroded away. So you end up with those very steep volcanic sort of profiles.
There's no flat, isn't it? It's straight from the ocean to the ridgeline.
Yeah, it's like straight up and straight down, which is great.
Yep. And what's the highest point on Banks Peninsula?
Banks Peninsula, the highest point is Mount Herbert, which is 919 meters. So it's pretty good. You can go, and you can run that right from the beach, so you can really get full 919 meters of elevation on that.
That's nice. What are your other favorites from Christchurch?
So I do quite a lot of running out. We've got a place called Bottle Lake Forest, and we've got all the coastal sections. So there's some great coastal running out there. And I actually really enjoy running on sand. So running on those soft sandy trails, I find is really... Yeah,
okay, you like it. I haven't heard many trail runners say that. The orienteers love it, but
I really love it. Runners, not so much. It really strengthens your legs in a way that you don't get even on, you know, technical trails or anything like that. Running on that soft sand and trying to learn to run fast on that, it's really the art of learning to lift the feet and move across the top of the sand rather than trying to push off and drive.
Damn, I didn't think I'd hear that from a trail runner, but you spend enough time running on it, you realize that the optimum technique is different.
It's very different,
you lose energy when you push down. You need to find this way of moving across the surface when you're not
pushing
down into that soft
sand.
There's
so many beautiful deserts in the world that I would love to visit. So I've been to the Sahara a couple of times, which I'm incredibly grateful for that experience. And I definitely want to get out to the Namibian desert. But there's just some amazing... the desert for me is one of the most beautiful places on Earth. Just the solitude and just the overwhelming sense of nature. When you get out in the Sahara, and there's no roads, there's no villages, there's no... Mm. There's no infrastructure out there. It's just pure nature, and it's just all sculpted by wind and sun and just sand. It's beautiful.
Do you get some sense of perspective as well when you're out there? Because you could spend some time, like I spend a lot of time in forests where you're actually very intimate with what's going on, and you don't feel like the world's particularly big. You're like, you're just trying to get over the next little hill. But then there's some environments when suddenly you're like, woof.
Yeah.
In proportion to the environment, I'm a speck.
Exactly. And I think the desert, I mean, you just need to look at the sorts of stories that we have in our culture. It's like the biblical stories. It's Jesus going out and spending 40 days in the desert and then coming back a transformed person. I think the desert has that sort of power that you can go out there and you realize how small you are. But in that smallness, or that learning to let go of your attachment to your sense of self, I think there's some part of you that can be unlocked by those sorts of experiences.
Yeah, at quite a superficial level, I feel like the desert is quite bare bones.
Yeah.
Like there's not much to do.
Yeah.
There's not much to interact with.
Yeah.
And so you don't get distracted by all those other things, and you are kind of left to observe the obvious.
Yeah.
Tiny.
And when you're out there as well, it's very inhospitable. So everything that you in our day-to-day lives, we appreciate comfort and things being at least having some form of entertainment or some form of something nice to look forward to, something nice to eat or something nice to drink. When you get out in the desert, I was really lucky that in 2018 I got to do the Marathon des Sables, which is the famous 7-day stage race through the desert. And that was just such a beautiful and transformative and powerful experience, so much more than just a running event. It was really an adventure and an experience in your own resilience. You got put out in the desert. Everything was taken out of your control. So the race organizers decide everything. They decide when the race starts, what you have to take, how the sleeping arrangements are going to be. Everything is out of your control. So you turn up, you put yourself in their hands. And so in some way, you've already surrendered some sense of control. And then everything is limited out there. You're limited to the amount of food you're carrying with you. So there's no room for treats and things that you might often look forward to. You have to, all of those get left behind. You've got just the absolute minimum sleeping setup just to keep you alive. You've got basically one set of clothes that you try and, you know, rinse out after the stage. And so it was really wonderful to see that I could still be completely happy without all of those things that we somehow base some sense of sort of happiness on, you could say.
Can you compare that to just doing a run locally, like 1 hour drive to somewhere that's still very tough terrain?
Yeah.
But you've got that like lifeline. There's some conceptual attachment to
home.
Yeah, and I think
what's the difference between those two?
Yeah, it's like a hugely different experience, because I would say a normal race, even if you're doing a really tough ultra marathon, you're going to turn up to the start line. Everything is under your control until the moment the gun goes, and then as soon as you finish the race, you're your own boss again. You can go back to your hotel. You can go eat what you want, do what you want. Mm-hmm. Marathon to subs, you turn up, and as soon as you turn up out there at the camp, everything is under the control of the race. So you've already got to let go of some sense of control. And then because you're living that experience day after day after day, it becomes much, much more immersive. And so your connection to the people around you becomes much deeper, but also your connection to place and to where you are in the world. And just being in these stunning, sometimes you would be running along and it seems like you were in a set of a movie. It just seems like so cinematic. You'd be running along on this hugely vast plain, of hard desert terrain. And then in the distance, you've got a row of sand dunes butted up against a huge mountain range. And then you're running along out there, and after a couple of hours, you come across one of the nomadic guys walking along with his camel. And it just seems like you're running through this whole other world. And that was something really, it was a really transformative experience.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And I can't relate personally. I haven't been out to any of these more remote environments.
Yeah.
So, something to...
Something to look forward to.
Yeah, to do at some stage. I'm not sure if I'll be tackling a 7-day, but...
Yeah.
And the things that I might end up doing might be closer to adventure racing, where you're with people and there's a lot of... I guess that there is contact each day with the races you're talking about, each night you're staying. So it's exactly. actually relatively similar. The degree of isolation is relatively similar. Can you tell me a bit more about some of your recent travels, and was there one to Mongolia recently?
Yeah. So I'm really lucky. So I when I started trail running seriously was 2009. I did my first ultra marathon, and then 2010 I won Kepler Challenge, and that really opened a lot of doors for me. And at that point, it was being in the right place at the right time. The sport of ultra trail running was really starting to boom internationally. And so suddenly, if you win a big race in New Zealand and you're considered one of New Zealand's top runners, that would open doors to get you into races all over the world. Mm-hmm. So since 2010, I've been really lucky in that every year I've been able to travel for 3, 4, 5, 6 months racing and getting to go to some of the more interesting and inspiring places on earth.
What were you doing before 2009, sports-wise?
So before that, I was still working my way up to ultramarathons. So I started as a runner running track, and then I moved on to 5K, 10K, half marathon. Yeah. And then I was running a few marathons. And I always had this inkling that the longer stuff suited me better. When I'd run with some of the top local guys, I couldn't keep with them in speed work. But when it came to long runs on the hills, I was definitely one of the guys who was at the front pushing the pace along. So I always felt that was something where I could be more competitive, or my talents lay more in that direction.
Yeah, and there's a natural gravitation towards those that you do better.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting thing, how we do naturally tend towards things that we get better results at. I always wonder whether that is the socialization. When we do well, people give us, compliment us, and we get that support and that encouragement. And that was definitely what started me on running. When you're a young teenager and you have success and you win something, then everyone gives you attention and encourages you. And so that kind of pushed me forwards. But I think that's a very shallow approach, or a shallow way to approach the sport, because I think running, for me in particular, is something much deeper than just the results and the success. So I've always liked to play around at different distances. So some people, once they get into ultra marathons, that's normally, if that's what they're successful at, they don't like to really step down and do shorter races. But this winter, I've really enjoyed racing the local cross country season. It's like 8 kilometers, 9 kilometers, 10 kilometers. So it's not really exactly in my wheelhouse, but the experience that you get is being able to be at your absolute limit and pushing as hard as you can and competing with different people and being challenged in a different way. So I always have tried to keep mixing it up and not just pigeonhole myself as an ultramarathoner.
Yeah, and that comes back to what strategy for development is best, to work more on your strengths or work more on your weaknesses.
Yeah.
What actually improves you more at the end of the day.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Probably different individuals will respond differently.
And I always find, though, that it's those workouts that you find easier psychologically to do, those are the things that often for me will be my bread and butter. So I love doing something like a long progression run. So I might do 2 hours on some trails and just start off at a moderate pace and just build into it. And for me, that's something that it doesn't take much to get me psyched up to go and do something like that. So that's really easy to head out the door and do that.
Yeah.
Whereas when it comes to shorter, harder intervals, those sort of things, I need to concentrate and really get myself in the right sort of mental space for that. But then once you finish those workouts as well, especially, it's that funny relationship between the more you're dreading doing the workout, the happier you are when you finish it. And so I see that with a lot of athletes. There's the workout that's each week on the program, the one they're really not looking forward to. That's normally when they look back on the week, that was the thing they were most happy that they actually got through. So it's something about that challenge being right at the limit of your capacity and then feeling that satisfaction that you actually got through and you performed and you were able to get through that experience. I think that's always a good feeling.
Yeah, that's definitely my experience, that the things that are tougher are generally more rewarding. I wanted to jump back. You mentioned that we are getting a lot of satisfaction from performance and from social celebration of performance. Have you had an experience of noticing a time when you are getting a lot of satisfaction? Maybe you're alone, so there's no chance that this is related to a social input or an external input. It's a very much internal satisfaction.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's become over time with the sport of running, because I've been training at a fairly serious level for about 20 years now. So I've got a good background in trying different techniques of training, trying different approaches. And what I've found over time is that the more I can be focused entirely on my own performance and trying to seek for that particular moment within a race or that particular period of time within a race. And for me, it's often the time, for me, most races, the most difficult part is that period when you're about sort of three quarters of the way through the race. You've already been going for a considerable period of time and you still have a fair distance to go. So an ultra marathon, you might be at sort of kilometer 50 to 60 and you might have 80 kilometers, it might be an 85 kilometer race or something like that. And so it's in the moments where I feel myself most challenged and most tested. And it's how I respond in those moments that really gives me the most satisfaction from a race, because for me personally, I'm putting myself out there to really push up as far or as close as I can to my possible limits of performance. And you feeling when you're getting to that point and you're sort of playing with that edge and you're getting feedback from your body telling you, okay, we're right on the limit here. We're not actually sure if we can actually maintain this pace all the way to the finish. And it's getting to that point and then staring that experience in the face and being completely aware of that and choosing to push on regardless, to almost take like that heroic approach. And that's something that I think when you look back on the race, you personally know in that moment whether you pushed on and gave everything you possibly had, or you backed off and took it a little bit easier just to save yourself for the finish.
Could I clarify something there? So, just to clarify what you mean about pushing off, is it more of a physical pushing on or more of a mental pushing on? Because you can think of the counterexample where you're actually being driven far too much by like lofty goals and like kind of the ego of winning and being the champion. It's actually smarter to be more realistic. And so backing off might be physically easier, but emotionally harder.
Yeah.
So do you want to clarify what you mean?
So for me, it's being able to be as comfortable as I can with the discomfort. So take myself to the high, like I don't like to really even use the word pain or suffering or discomfort. I like to talk about intensity, because for me, I like to try and keep the experience as neutral as possible. So when you're out there running and you're pushing hard, your body's giving you feedback.
Yeah.
And I like to think that feedback is actually just neutral. It's saying your body's trying to give you as much possible information as you can to use to make decisions. And so if you take that as a neutral experience, and or like when I talk about it, I like to use the word intensity. So there's a certain level of intensity the feedback is giving you. Yeah. And as you're racing, and if you try and go faster, that level of feedback goes higher because the intensity of the feedback coming from the body yeah. goes higher and higher. And most of us get to a certain point where the body perhaps had capacity to keep going at that same speed for a period of time, but it's our own mind or our psyche that can't take that level of intensity, and we want to back off. And so that's also why when you get close to the finish line, suddenly you can speed up. Even if you thought you were absolutely dead and you couldn't go any faster, yeah. suddenly you see the finish line a kilometer away, and suddenly you can pick it up and run considerably faster. So there's some more capacity that the body's holding back.
Yeah.
And so it's that line like inside my own psyche that I'm trying to ride, where I'm trying to allow as much of that intensity into my being as possible. And then trying to stay there and be comfortable with it. Yeah. Trying to not back off just to release that intensity just because there's some part of me that is resisting it. So I want to embrace that experience. And so the more I can embrace it, I think it's more about being as present as possible and embracing that as that experience as fully as possible. That's really what I'm looking to do. And I know when I've done that, I know when I get to the finish line, it doesn't matter what the clock says or my placing. I know that I was right on that limit of what I could handle, and I chose to stay there, and I chose to embrace it, and I chose to be present. And in some ways, it's actually incredibly enjoyable. It's incredibly freeing, because in those moments, you're so engaged and connected to what you're doing that every single other part of you has been left behind. It's like your ego, your name, your job, your title, your family, your friends, all your responsibilities. And that moment, there's no space for any of those other things. So for me, it's one of the most fully alive experiences you can possibly have.
Yeah.
And so that's really what I'm looking for in a race. And if I can get close to that experience, or I can be somewhere in that realm of giving myself fully to the moment and to the experiences, then I'll walk away completely satisfied. It doesn't matter what the clock says.
Did the word perfect flow mean anything to you when you first heard it?
Yeah, so I mean, flow is something that I've really been interested for a long period of time, because flow for me is one word that probably comes closest to capturing what that experience is. When you've the separation between you and the activity has really ceased to exist. You simply become the act of running or jumping or cycling or whatever activity is that you do. So there's that sense that the self-conscious part of yourself has started to slip away, and you've become fully identified with what you're trying to do. And then also I'm really interested in the way that your perspective and your experience of time changes when you're in that experience as well. So because I've heard people like some of the greatest sprinters in the world. I remember hearing Carl Lewis talk about the 100-meter final, and he was talking about it in a way that would make you think it took 20 minutes. He was talking about the experience of coming out of the blocks, and he was paying attention to different cues and when what he was focusing on at different points in the race. And he was even talking about how he could see individual flashbulbs going in the stands. And if you've seen at the Olympics, it's just like a sea of camera flashes. And so to have that absolute presence in the moment that everything seems to be going much slower. And so that's one extreme. And I think for distance athletes and people competing in events that take 20 minutes, half an hour, 1 hour, 2 hours, 10 hours, your perspective changes. And I've had that so many times where I'm doing a long race and I'm just focusing on my fueling and my moving through the course as efficiently as possible. And it's often on a training run, I might have gone out for 2 hours, 3 hours. I'll come back home and I think, my God, like, where did that time go? Often the hardest thing for me in a long run is the first hour. It's like you get into the experience and you still have your day-to-day thoughts and all of the things that you're processing in life. But at some point in the run, you get really into that moment, and then suddenly the next 4 hours can pass just like in the blink of an eye. So I think that's really interesting.
Yeah. Have you noticed that changes with the size of the challenge ahead of you? I can think of examples with just training runs.
Yeah.
I'm always excited about racing.
Yeah.
So that always goes in a similar way to as you described. But I've also noticed that in some longer runs where, the day before I'm like, Yeah. This is going to be, I better not screw this up. Otherwise, yeah. if I hit the wall, this is going to take a long time.
Yeah.
And it's those runs that go the fastest. I think it's easier to slip into that state of connection with what you're doing.
Yeah.
When it's a harder challenge, there's that mental arousal is right there from the start. Yeah. And you're like, better not screw this up.
Yeah. I suppose in some way that is true. I mean, I like to try and take the same approach. One of my key things I think in life is that the way you approach any individual part of your life has to correspond how you want to approach your life as a whole. And so I think I take that into my training. And when I look at running per se, I look at running as not something as separate from my life. I look at it as one of the many sort of branches of my life tree. And so if the way I want to approach my running is also the way I want to approach being a good human being and being a good, you know, member of society and being a good friend and all of those different other aspects in my life. And so within my running as well, I think what I like to try and do is to not make any one particular run or workout any more important than any other one, to see the value in every single run that I go out for. Mm. And some, like, for example, on Saturday night, I just went out for a 30-minute shakeout run. It was just such a wondrous run. I just was so present. Mm. I was so, and I totally enjoyed it. I was like, looking back on my week, I was like, wow, that was a really great run.
That was the best run of my week.
It was like a 30-minute shakeout, but it was, I saw the value in what I was doing. And I think that's a really key thing as well, because it's often easier for us to see the value in the really big, hard things that we do. And then we sort of disregard the 40-minute shakeout run here, or the easy 1 hour on that day, or the little stride out session on the other day. And I think all of those runs, obviously you can't bring the same intensity to every single run. You don't want to burn yourself out. You've only got so much psychological energy to put towards things. But I think just staying relaxed and really, it's like that idea of embracing the process. Each run is part of the process, and trying to be present and trying to acknowledge each of these little steps along the way is being equally as important. And so that's what I...
Yeah, and you mentioned process, and that's what I was... That would have been another way to describe the way you were describing your race earlier, that you're very much focused on the process of trying to get the most out of yourself,
exactly,
as opposed to kind of stuck in as the victim of the situation. You're very much in control, and sometimes you feel like, you know, you're observing a dashboard, and you're like, oh, that dial's in the red zone, I want to tone it back, or that dial's sitting on easy, I probably should push it closer to the red zone.
Yeah, I think that's really the key thing. It's when I focus on process, it's all something that is internal for me, something that I have absolute control over. I think the thing that makes you feel stressed out, and because when you turn up to a race, you're basically lining up and the whole world in front of you is just chaos, because you can't know what is going to happen as soon as that gun goes off. You don't know what the other runners are going to do. You don't even know exactly how your body's going to respond. And so that's really difficult to deal with. When you're completely surrounded by chaos, that's really hard to deal with psychologically. But if you have some things, you want to get that, it's like the idea of Taoism. You've got the famous, the yin-yang symbol, which is the white and black and within a circle. And so it's half white, half black. And so the idea in Taoism that you should be trying to walk the middle line between those two things. So that's the black and the white are representing order and chaos. And so you need to have one foot in order and one foot in chaos. If you're too much in order, there's not enough stimulation, there's not enough newness, there's not enough potential. And if you're too much in chaos, you don't have any structure. And so I think I take that approach into running, in that I know that the outer circumstance is this world of chaos, that you can't control all of these outer facets. But I can control what I can control. So I can control my effort levels. I can control where I put my thoughts. I can control where I put my concentration. And so trying to keep that balance where I've got that structure of order that I can control and that I'm comfortable with, but then I'm pushing myself out into that chaos. And I think that's a really beautiful fine line to be able to walk.
Yeah, I think we think about this remarkably similar, actually.
Yeah.
I think you say it nicer than I could say it.
Yeah, it's because it's not really a conversation that we have in our culture, because in the Western culture, we've always approached, or nearly always approached sports just from the purely physical point of view. And we've seen psychological training as some sort of adjunct that, you know, possibly it might have some benefit. But a lot of people might think that it's only if you're having problems that you would actually look in that area. Whereas for me, I actually see that the psychological part is perhaps the most important part, because you see a lot of people with physical capacity. There's so many kids, like how many kids do you see? You go to an athletics day, you see so many kids coming through secondary school champs, just amazingly talented athletes. But how many of those kids go on to reach their full potential, and how many of those kids go on to really embrace the sport? And I think a lot of that is because we don't give them the psychological structures or the mental structures. So either they find the sport too stressful because they don't know how to deal with the pressures. And as you go up in the age groups, it becomes more and more pressure. And so as a kid, someone might have done really well when they're 12, 13, 14, because they were just running for the enjoyment of it. And then suddenly it's all about goals. It's all about times. It's all about medals. It's all about placings. And then it's about looking at a pathway to future representative honors and all of those things. And so suddenly the reasons and the mindset that drove someone to great success at a certain age, that actually starts to get left behind, and everything becomes much more focused on external factors. And I think for a lot of people, that becomes really difficult. And you see, especially when kids go from high school into the university environment, so they've gone from a very structured environment in their home life, and suddenly they've got the freedom, suddenly they don't have the push that perhaps their parents or their coaches were giving them. And so suddenly they just drift away, or their performances fall off. And so I think there's a lot that could be learned for everyone involved in sport, and how do we teach a way that sport still is meaningful and feels, you still keep that sense of playfulness, but you're moving towards higher and higher levels of performance. Because I don't think they're mutually exclusive.
Right.
I don't think you have to be entirely analytical to perform at the highest level. And you only need to go to Kenya or somewhere like that and see the amazing runners coming out of ITEN. I mean, they're not coming from a real rigorous sort of, they're not coming from the same mindset at all in some ways as Western athletes are. And I think that's actually one of their great strengths. There's this freedom, and this there's not the limitations put in their minds as to what's possible that we tend to build up over time with our more analytical approach to sports.
Yep. Do you think there's also some social elements that kind of get intertwined with that also? And maybe, yeah, I'm not sure like what's causing what, but we do notice an orientarian, at least a no man's land, when people realize that they're not going to do the commitment to push to the elite level.
Yeah.
Maybe they're junior elite, but they're not pushing to senior elite, because that is a serious step up and commitment of years of, you know, years of just getting your ass kicked before you actually can compete on a reasonable playing field. And you end up with a lot of people disappearing and they come back later at some stage. But it would be really nice to be able to frame the sport in a way that still was very engaging for those people, that you realize there's actually a lot to be experienced here without having to be and a senior elite athlete. So how do you see that gap being fulfilled? And is it just a social thing, that there's lots of other interesting things going on at life?
Yeah.
Or is it that the experience is not really aligned quite as we'd like to see it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a big problem that all sports are facing, and especially with the sort of model we use towards high performance sport in New Zealand, where funding and a lot of the money flows to medals. And so suddenly everything is measured by those outer circumstances and those outer measures of success. And I think for a lot of athletes, they get to that point, and because especially going from a junior to a senior, the transition is huge, because juniors, everything is split up into smaller and smaller age groups. So you're in a smaller and smaller pond. And so the chance of you having outward success is much higher, because the playing field is much smaller. So, and you see that in a lot in athletics as well, that, you know, you've got all the separate age groups, the under 20s, the under 18s. And so suddenly when you step up to the seniors, suddenly you're competing against everyone. And so the chance of you being successful straight away is really low. And so if you'd come through and your measure of success has always been podiums, medals, then you're going to find it really, really difficult because you're not going to be able to just step up straight away to seniors and be meddling against guys who are 7, 8, 9 years older than you and are really experienced. And so I think that's where our conversation around sports has to be looking more at the... It's not the internal benefits that you get and really celebrating that sense of internal and personal fulfillment you get when you get out there and compete and celebrating people who get out there and compete at their own best capacity. It's not just about celebrating the one or two at the top. It's just recognizing that there is real inherent value at doing something difficult and challenging yourself constantly. And that's what the biggest lesson that I've learned over time is for me, running or any sport is much more than just the results. It's really that ability and that opportunity to focus on a practice that I can measure and I can see if I need to. But it's like having this practice or this art that, or craft that I'm constantly working towards trying to perfect in some way. But it doesn't mean that I'm trying to become always faster because there's all these little sub elements of your performance. And for me, a lot of that is where my mind is when I'm performing. And so celebrating that itself, that journey of self discovery through the sport is inherently something really, really powerful. And that's something that you don't really find in a lot of other areas of life. And so I think sports is one of those great ways because it's that amazing, it's that coming together of the body and the mind or the spirit. There's that the physical body is trying to perform, but it's you're also your own mental state that provides either the impetus to go further or is pulling you back.
Yeah, I definitely notice a lot of that. And I kind of wish it was more obvious to communicate some of these things. I think it's, I can frame it in that way, but then putting that into practice, it still seems like the social incentives kind of override.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it takes a certain sort of person, I think, and it takes some time to value it. And I think a lot of people who walk away from the sport, it's only after several years do they actually realize what they've lost in their lives. Because the thing is, endurance sport in particular takes a lot of commitment, it takes a lot of concentration, it takes a lot of time and discipline, and it just takes a lot of hard effort over a long period of time. And so there's some part of you that perhaps would think that life would be better if you didn't have to make that effort, if you could just relax a little bit more and you didn't need to worry about going out in the morning in the pouring rain in winter. There's some part of you that would obviously think, wow, that'd be great. We could just stay in bed. That would be beautiful. Mm. But it's when people actually have the freedom to do that and they do that for some period of time, why did they then come back to the sport? I think it's because they realize that there's something missing that the rest of their life isn't providing them with. And I think that's that opportunity. Because I think for a lot of us in the past, we've had battles to fight, whether it was physical and, you know, on the actual battlefield. But human beings have dealt with incredibly trying circumstances since the very beginning of our existence. And so we have always been at the mercy of nature and of our own frailty and myriad forces working against us. And so there was this constant struggle to survive. And I think when you get to that point where you remove all sense of struggle from your life actually begins to, some sense of meaning and purpose begins to drift away. It's like when you talk to people and there's this vision of, oh, when I retire, you know, I'll see myself sitting at the beach, you know, just having a beer and just relaxing. And it's like, okay, you know, maybe you'd like to do that for 1 or 2 days. But most people, you get to a certain point where you start to get that urge to challenge yourself again, because there's something about challenging yourself that allows you to actually appreciate and enjoy the comforts of life. I mean, for me, I always say that you never enjoy a bag of chips and sitting on your couch like you do after you've just finished running 100 kilometers. It's like you get back from that, you put your feet up, you've got some snacks. It's just the most wonderful moment. It's like in that moment, you've really captured the essence of what sitting on the couch can be. But if every day you come home from work and just sit on the couch and eat a bag of chips, I mean, how satisfying is that? I think the satisfaction is incredibly low then. So
yeah. So I haven't been working full time for about a year, maybe 2 years now.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe a long time. Anyway, I went from overcommitted to undercommitted.
Yeah.
And that first month of work was like the greatest month of my life.
Mm.
And then like, what the hell happened after that?
Yeah.
Everything just went downhill.
Yeah.
Everything was too easy.
Yeah.
And so I was just like feeling like, wow, man, like my mental space is not what it usually is.
Yeah.
Like little problems are now big obstacles.
Yeah.
And I'm like lying in bed at night feeling like kind of crappy.
Yeah.
I'm not really ready to go to bed. I'm not really satisfied. Yeah. And yeah, that was my first experience with something that is similar to what you're describing. And it totally caught me by surprise.
I think
because it went from like real satisfied.
Yeah.
Like, well, this is what it feels like to be fully slept.
Yeah.
And this is what it feels like to, you know, have more time to deal with these little niggly things in my life. And now that I've got rid of those, since then, I've just been like, I need more commitment. Like, I need things to do because I get that stress and that engagement and that concentration. And I'm not faffing with these problems that should not exist.
Yeah, I think there's something very true about that. It's when you choose willingly to take a responsibility on your shoulders, like, so you're choosing to carry a weight, you actually feel as though that there is some more meaning and purpose in your life than if you're just trying to avoid obligation. And so a lot of the time when you do have responsibilities, but you haven't yet embraced them, you feel as though they're imposed upon you. That's real suffering. If you're doing something and you're doing it out of a sense of obligation and that you don't want to be doing it and you haven't been able to willingly choose to take that responsibility on, then that's real suffering. And you could wish, oh, I just wish I didn't have any responsibilities. But on the other side, when you get to that point of having zero responsibility, suddenly there's something in you that starts needling you, just telling you you could be doing more. There's something more in you that needs to be pulled out. So it's like some sense, some people will talk about the conscience, the voice of conscience or your intuition, but it's definitely something on some deeper level when you're not being all that you can. It will remind you that you're not being all that you can, which is funny because it's you yourself are choosing to do this. Yeah. It's like you may be sitting there every night and just eating a whole bunch of ice cream. It's like, okay, I'm choosing to do this. But then at the same time that night, this voice or this feeling within you will come and say, hey, you're really not doing what you should be doing. And it's like, that's really interesting when you start to see that there's these different voices within us, these different parts of us that have different, perhaps, aims. And then it starts to be, oh, okay, this is a game I could be playing here. Like, how could I try and get all of the parts of me focused and moving in the same direction?
Yeah. And just for the listener, I guess those voices probably don't sound like human voices.
No.
But they're signals, again, like the dashboard is telling you something. And maybe that's a dial you didn't realize were there. You've got to dust it off and figure out what this dial pertains to. What's the mechanics behind it?
Yeah. Because I would say if you really looked at your own life and thought, okay, how much of my full potential am I bringing out? How much am I actually living and manifesting in my life? And for most of us, it's not that high. We all know that we have so much more capacity and we have so much more that we could possibly be doing. And I think that's something that ties closely in with meaning. And I think that meaning is for me the key thing in life. It's trying to follow meaning. It's like doing things that feel meaningful to me, doing things that make my life feel as though that has a purpose and that it has, and I feel an internal sense of value in what I'm doing. And that's going to be completely different for everyone. Like, and that's the difficult thing, because our society doesn't show all the possible options and the possible ways you could chase meaning. A lot of the time society will tell us that you should be chasing meaning through your material possessions or through your career or just through relationships. But there's so many different ways. And so trying to find what it is in your life that makes you feel as though that this is all worth it. Because the thing is, life is suffering. It's we're all going to end up, we all die, everyone we know dies, everything falls apart. So it's like, no matter how hard we try and hold things together, no matter how comfortable and how much we try and insulate ourselves from suffering, the suffering we're going to end up suffering one way or another. And so I don't think trying to avoid suffering is a long-term path to success in life. Instead, it's find something that makes the suffering worthwhile.
Yeah.
It's like, find something that makes you feel as though this is meaningful and this has value and this is worth doing despite all of the problems in the world, despite the suffering that we all have to endure.
You mentioned something before about getting you, what were you saying? Kind of to do with reward, the reward of putting in an effort
yep.
over something that it might be challenging. Have you spent much time coaching?
Yeah, so I've coaching was always something that I was going to move towards. So I actually studied sports coaching back in 2001, 2002. And at that point, there wasn't really a big market for running coaching in a paid sense. And so that's something that especially ultramarathoning, I think, you know, we have to really thank ultramarathoning for allowing the number of running coaches that exist now. Because without ultramarathoning, that probably wouldn't have happened. Because when you get people who take on a big challenge like that, a lot of them want someone to help them out because that's a big undertaking. And so actually just this year with the lockdown and the lack of traveling, I decided to that I would take on more responsibility as a sports coach. And so now I'm coaching several more athletes. And I'm finding that incredibly satisfying. And I always saw coaching as something that I would move towards. And you never know exactly when the moment is going to be right. But I really just felt this year was the time to put out that, take that opportunity out.
I think when I was growing up and dabbling in coaching as I was also developing as an athlete, the thinking at the time was that it's really important to provide emotional rewards and incentives to keep pulling people through. And in the past few years, I've seen some, not necessarily counter evidence, but evidence that while that might be a good way to start, it might not be the best way to continue long term. And there was some research looking at the way people train animals, for example, and how they maybe start feeding the dolphin the fish and then they just go to like a clicker sound or like some sound that the dolphin hears, and once they've figured out that this is good, they get the same emotional satisfaction from and the idea is that you're communicating proficiency neutrally. You're communicating this is the art that you're developing, and what you've just done is good. And so if you get to that state, then the person who's learning, given that they're working in this environment, has to be engaged with the process. They're aligned with what they're trying to do. They're not trying to seek your approval. They're not trying to seek satisfaction from those around you. They're purely trying to become more proficient at the skill. Are those ideas that you've thought about?
Yeah, I mean, I do think about sports coaching quite often, in that it's one of those things where it's half science and half the theory behind it, but also it's half being empathetic and present and having those human emotional connections and those skills at reading someone and really communicating. And so I think I really enjoy it because of that. It's someone could write the best schedules in the world, but the way they communicate with their athletes could be suboptimal, and so they could miss out on some of the potential growth and opportunities that their athletes could have. And for me, my great love is in coaching athletes is seeing people grow into something more, to take that step into the unknown and take challenges on, and to do things that they perhaps were unsure that they had the capacity to do. And I'm always amazed how a little bit of encouragement and faith, just giving that to your athletes, how powerful that can be. Because I've seen so many people come through and seen them do things they think they couldn't do, that you start to see that human potential is actually a lot more malleable than a lot of people perhaps realize. And so when I set programs for people and things, set a schedule that's quite challenging, I said it, but I also have absolute faith in that person and give them the absolute, I try and give them that faith and confidence and belief that although this looks really challenging, I've got all confidence in you that you have the capacity to do this. And sometimes that's all people have needed, because that's one thing that we're actually not that good at, is actually providing people with encouragement, especially when people are trying to transform their lives and become better versions of themselves. Often the negative human emotions start coming up. If you see someone in your family or someone that you know start to really change their life and try and do something really positive, we should all celebrate that. That's a wondrous thing, because that's making humankind as a species a better. It's bringing up the standard of everyone. But it's easy sometimes for people's jealousies and insecurities and fears to come to the fore, and people can easily criticize other people. And I think that's one of the worst things to see, where people try and bring someone down who's actually trying to to take a step into something that's difficult and challenging, trying to be courageous and grow. So I always see that's a really great thing when you can offer that support and encouragement, you see that growth and you see that person step into that new domain and do something that they perhaps were worried and afraid and didn't know that they could really do. Because you know that doesn't affect just their sporting career. You know that then flows into every other aspect of their lives. When they've got that confidence, when they've got that self-belief, that allows them in their career, it allows them in their family situation and their friendships to step out and be a better version of themselves.
When somebody has achieved something that they maybe they were unconfident about beforehand and they have achieved it, how do you respond to affirm their achievement? Is it very much just to satisfy their emotions, or at one end is it like good, next thing?
Yeah,
obviously they're two extremes.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you have to deal with, because each person and each athlete has their own psychological makeup, and so they've got their own drivers and their own this is one of the interesting things I find with ultra marathoning. So people have decided that they want to run a 100-kilometer race or a 100-mile race, and you can ask them, why do you want to do this? And they'll say, well, you know, I need a challenge, or, you know, I've done a marathon, I've done a 50K race, and so I want to take on a bigger challenge. And I never really buy that that's the reason they're doing it, because these things are really difficult. And when you see someone doing it, you realize how difficult these things are. And especially if you're someone who's going to do a 100K race and it might take you 20 hours, that's a lot of time on your feet. And that's a huge undertaking. And what I think it is more that, I think we all have this part of us. It's like, why do we become interested in certain things? I don't think we ever really decide consciously that, oh, I'm going to be interested in playing hockey, or I'm going to be interested in chess. It's, you see someone playing it, you see a representation of it, and and some part of you recognizes that in that activity, there is some growth for you. There's some quality, there's some part of you that could be brought to the fore by you doing that thing. And I think a lot of people, when they've seen maybe the Tarawera Ultra Marathon video, they see these people out there and they see in these people that these people are bringing forward some quality, some bravery, some heroic state, some dynamism, some discipline, whatever it is, that they see something in these people and some part of them recognizes this is what you need to do. Not because you need to run 100 kilometers, because no one needs to run 100 kilometers. But each of us need to become a better version of ourselves. I don't think any of us is the finished product. And I think when you think you are, I think that's when you stop growing. And then I think when I see my athletes, that they might have different reasons why they claim that they're doing this race. But I really feel that on some level that some part of them has felt some meaning or purpose in doing this, and that they're going to do it and they're going to get that result. And so it kind of depends on the individual, how I would speak with them. But I do try and call out that idea that there is something more. There should be something more in why you're doing any activity than just the simple act of doing the activity. I think we should be using everything we're doing in our lives to try and better ourselves. In one way or another, it might be that just doing this activity is going to make me more time focused and more disciplined. And so that has value, because then you can be more productive and you can be more useful to the people in your family and your community. So I think ultra marathons, just because they're such a profoundly powerful experience, when you go out there, you're heading off into the chaos, you're heading off into the unknown, into the woods, and you might be running all night. There's something, it's almost like some mythic heroic tale. Yeah. And because we don't have those adventures in our lives anymore, the world has become much more safe, and we've got, you know, you can look on Google Earth and study the far reaches of the Congo. So there's not these parts of the world outwardly that are unknown, but I think we still have a huge internal space that we haven't fully mapped, each of us. And so I think doing these outer adventures, like running 100 miles, that in some way allows you the space to explore the unexplored within you.
Yeah, I definitely noticed that. Now I can observe this. When I was younger and developing, I was on board that I wanted to, there were various reasons why I wanted to do sport. And now I realize that there's one reason. I like it.
Yeah,
it was just a mindful observation. It's that I like doing that. It feels good, and so that's, I think, for a lot of people, and for me, an important question to keep asking myself, because you don't want to get stuck, especially in performance sport where it's stressful, if that is not the primary reason that you're doing it. And I think a lot of people find themselves getting pulled in to high performance and the primary reason they're doing it isn't as simple as because I like doing it.
And
it's an unstable situation.
Exactly. And that's what I was meaning when I was talking about young people. Most people start doing an activity because they like the feeling of it. And I know for me, when I ran as a kid, I just loved the feeling of moving quickly and the world moving past me at a much faster rate and just feeling competent in the way I could move my body. And that's the sad thing, that normally our structures take away that initial, we start to lose over time that initial feeling for the enjoyment of the motion and the experience itself. And everything suddenly becomes about, oh, why are you doing this? Are you going to win it? Is that why you're doing it?
And that, everyone's looking at the results board too much at the finish rather than talking about the battle and the struggle and the challenges.
Yeah.
Cool. Can we jump a little bit more onto your background with Sri Chinmoy?
Yes.
Yeah, and explain who he is and why he's significant.
Yeah, so as I said, I did some running as a very young person. So I was when I was 10, 11, 12, 13, I was doing athletics at a club. And when I was 14, I think it was my last year as a junior athlete, and I'd gone up to the National Secondary School Champs, and my entire focus was on winning a medal. And I made some tactical mistakes, and I didn't even make it through the semi-final of my race. And so that was my first real big disappointment in life. And so until that point, I'd lived really an idyllic idyllic childhood, you know, growing up in the 80s, riding my BMX around. And it was a glorious time.
Yeah.
And so I went up there, and I had this really crushing disappointment. And for me, you could look at it as an adult in someone's perspective and say, well, you know, it's not that big a deal. You know, you can get, there's always another race. But for me, it was the first time that I really worked super hard towards a goal. And then I had nothing to show for it. I would always been, there was that story that if you work hard and you do the right thing, you'll get the results. And here I'd worked as hard as I could, made all the right choices, I thought, and I just got no result. And so that started me questioning why I was putting so much time and effort into running. And of course, at that point as well, you've got people, your friend group, and everyone is moving in different directions. And so I walked away from running, and I really didn't imagine that I'd find myself back to it, coming back to it. And so over the next short period of time, I started asking questions and was starting to become interested in what was next for me in life. And at that point, I was really, I could say, fortunate, or I could say I simply had an experience. And the experience was very simple. I just woke up early one morning. I was staying at a friend's house, and I decided to walk home. And I was walking home through the local park, and I was listening to my Walkman, and I was flicking through the stations, and I came to the sound of the ocean. It was just the sound of the waves washing in and washing out. And it was almost like the perfect situation. I had the sound of the ocean I was listening to. And at the moment I turned around, and I was watching, it was late summer, and I was watching the sunrise over the Port Hills. And I was in this park, and it was that early morning light, and it was very golden. It was just so beautiful. And I was so present and captured by that moment that suddenly I started to connect and feel some part of me that I'd never felt before. I felt that somehow there was some awareness within me that was much vaster and deeper than what I'd ever experienced before. And as I was breathing in, I could feel my awareness start to spread to the park around. I could feel this connection with the trees and the grass and the plants. And then I felt that expand again. I could feel this connection to the whole city. And this just continued for some 5-6 minutes. And I felt at that moment that I was no longer a separate entity or separate consciousness, insignificant in the vast span of the universe. I instead felt in that moment that I was an integral part of the consciousness of the entire universe. And so there was some connection between myself and the entire universe. I wasn't some separate thing, but I was completely connected to everything around me. And this is a common experience that people have in spiritual traditions, and people might talk about a transcendent experience, or the universal consciousness, or whatever terms you want to use. It doesn't really matter. It's just that you felt that suddenly your limited awareness, suddenly the walls have dissolved in some way. And a lot of people have experienced that through psychedelics. So you see in, you know, back in the 60s with LSD, and then currently with the big movement of ayahuasca and the from the shamanic traditions of Peru, there's a lot of people who started experimenting with the sense of being able to dissolve those boundaries of our limited self and connect with some far vaster or larger consciousness.
Also not uncommon that people have this experience off the cuff,
yes,
watching like a sunset or something that's
exactly
strikingly beautiful, and yeah, the brain gets itself just in this state.
Yeah.
Something turns off and it's like, yeah, boom.
And I
you're,
think,
you're
I
there.
Think,
and some people spend a lot of effort trying to get there.
And
you managed to get it just
that's the thing. And I had it without knowing what it was. And so that started a large series of questions for me. And I mean, a lot of us have had experience of it. Even people doing sports, there's sometimes where you're out somewhere beautiful, you might be running in the hills and there's a beautiful sunset, and you're just so in the flow of your body, you're so present, and you suddenly start to sense that there's something more to your existence than what you commonly experience. So it's not an uncommon experience, I don't think. But for me, it was just incredibly transformative, because suddenly it was like I looked behind the curtain and saw that the world was made up of something way more interesting than just the material objects around me. And so no one at school was talking about things like this, you know. So I'm talking with a bunch of 15-year-old guys, and that's very difficult because I'm speaking about an experience that's not commonly understood. And so I spent the next several years searching for what that experience was called, how to describe it, and how to recreate it. That was the key thing for me, because it was something that was so profound and beautiful that I was like, I want to learn to live in a way that I can feel that connection. I can feel and see that beauty around me. I can feel that sense of love and purpose. And so I was looking around. When I was about 18, I discovered that there was this practice called meditation. And I hadn't really, I didn't really know much about it. But as soon as I heard the word, I was like, okay, I think this is what I need to get involved in. And so when I was 18, I started looking around for some meditation workshops. And I saw in Christchurch there was a few different options, but most of them you had to pay for. And then I came across this flyer for the Sri Chinmoy Center. And so Sri Chinmoy is an Indian spiritual teacher. He was born in 1931, and he spent many, many years living in New York City. So he left India in 1964. And he was really, his entire aim and purpose was to try and spread this ancient wisdom of the practice of meditation and the connection to this transcendent consciousness or our own deeper nature. He wanted to spread that with people from all walks of life and all parts of the world. So I came along, they were offering some free meditation workshops, and I came along, and immediately that first session we did, I had that same exact experience from when I was 14. And so I was just overjoyed, because suddenly I'd found people who knew what I was talking about, and they actually knew what the key was to actually enter into that space. And so for those of you who haven't practiced meditation is incredibly simple. It's simply the practice of making your mind completely still and completely calm, and just sitting in that place of just absolute awareness and presence. So becoming as fully engaged and nested into the now as possible. And you do that by letting go of the thoughts, letting go of the rational thinking part of your mind, and just trying to, a good way to describe it, I could say to someone, would be if you imagine that your being was like a lake or the ocean. And very often we're just on the surface. So our mind is like the surface of the lake or the ocean. And so on the surface, it can be incredibly turbulent. This can be waves and crashing winds and all sorts of things. And that's very often the nature of the mind, is it's very busy and it's very complex and very stressful. But if you can learn to drop your awareness down from the surface down into the depths of the ocean or the depths of the lake, when you're down in the depths of a lake, it's incredibly still down there. When you're in the depths of the ocean, it's incredibly still and peaceful. And I really feel that. I can feel when my awareness starts to drop down from my mind and come down towards my heart. And then I feel this like sinking into this just beautiful sense of peace and connection, and all my worries just drift away, and I just feel completely at present and at one with the moment. And so that's kind of how one way we could visualize what we're doing when we meditate.
That seems quite rare that you manage to sit down the first time meditating and recreate that.
Yeah.
Is that rare, or is there a number of people who...
No, so I mean, if you come from the Indian tradition or the Eastern tradition, there's this idea that this stage we're on is not the only time we've been on the stage. Like I really like the Indian philosophy that the world is but a stage. It's like a drama, the cosmic drama. They call it the divine leela or the divine play. And so there's this idea coming from that tradition that you play one role and then you'll be off the stage for some time and then you'll come back again to play a different role and hopefully to learn something and to continue on in some evolutionary journey of consciousness. And so you could say that those people who find meditation incredibly easy in this lifetime, perhaps they'd practiced it at some point in the past. I mean, you can't prove these things one way or the other, so it's neither here nor there. But some people will have a tremendous capacity for meditation. Mm-hmm. So Sri Chinmoy, for example, at a very young age, when his parents passed away, he went to live in a spiritual community. And from the age of 12 years, he was able to easily sit down and meditate for 8, 9, 10, 12 hours right. per day of meditation. And so obviously he had some capacity for meditation that most people don't. But we all have the capacity to meditate because we all have the same fundamental constituents. We have the same internal structures, you could say. And so each of us can find a way, and it might be a different way for each person. And so there's many different styles of meditation, but it's finding a way that works for you to get yourself fully connected and present and to be able to let go of the analytical, rational part of your mind and just become at one with reality.
Yeah, and I think the tricky bit there is that in doing so, the surprising experience happens.
Yeah.
You think you're working towards, as you're saying, getting further below the turbulent surface of the ocean.
Yeah.
But then suddenly you get pushed out somewhere different.
Yeah.
So I think that's, where people are maybe a little bit confused. They're like, well, why be more calm? Like, why be more calm? But there's something that happens that you suddenly learn something very quickly and you're like, whoa, unexpected.
Yeah, because I think everything, like for me, what I'm looking to do in life is I want to become better skilled or better able to deal with reality. Because that's the one thing that we all share. We're all here in a human form trying to deal with this incredibly complex system that's all around us.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the question for me is how best to deal with this reality around us. And we could try different things. We could think, okay, let's just be completely focused on myself and I'll lie and I'll cheat and I'll steal and I'll see how that goes and I'll see if that works. I don't think that works. I think people have tried that and it may work for some period of time, but I think it always catches up with you.
Yeah.
And I don't think you really get away with anything you think you got away with. Like no one may have called you out on it that day or that week or that month, but those are the moments when you betrayed someone or you let someone down. You know what you did and you can't ever escape from that. And so I think the question for me is how best to deal with reality. And I think meditation is the one tool that I've found that has best given me the ability to deal with reality in a way that I'm more aware of the reality around me. So I can see things more clearly perhaps. And so that's a really good first step. Like even if you were just more aware of what's going on around you, whether it's, in your family, in your work situation, in your activities you do, just being more aware allows you to actually start to see ways that you could begin to make positive changes in those situations.
Yeah. And an obvious example of that would be to notice actually what you enjoy in your sport.
Yeah.
And to be able to be present and aware of how the immediate experiences you're having, not the concepts that you use to describe those experiences, but actually what is the experience you're having.
Yeah.
To be able to see that for what it is
enables
you to then realize what you're actually responding to.
Yeah.
So that's an example of someone still confused about what the utility is here.
Yeah.
There's an obvious example.
Yeah. And I think even more profound is the way it can actually begin to seep into and connect with decision making, because we all know it's incredibly difficult to know for certain what's the right thing to do. I mean, like if you're a young person and you're thinking about your career now, like what are the potential career options? A million? It's like it seems like there's an infinite variety of things you could possibly spend your time doing, and it's so difficult to know what you should spend your time doing then. And that's an incredibly profound problem. It's like if you've finished high school or you've just finished your degree and you don't know what you should be doing, like that's a huge problem. And I think meditation, because it is connecting with some part of you that is deeper than that rational, analytical part of your brain, because you could make a list and you could look at all the different possible careers that you're considering, and then you could try and look at the pros and the cons. you still are missing out on an infinite amount of information that you don't have. So you can never rationally decide what's going to be the best career to take on. But I think on some way, and I think meditation has taught me this, is that there is a way to start to feel, and you get a sense of, when you look at one particular option, you just get a sense of meaning and purpose in that. You just feel that I can't say exactly why or how I know this, but I know on some deeper level that if this is the right thing for me to do. And very often, and then it's a matter of faith, because then you have to think, okay, well, I'm not exactly sure why I know, or it feels as though I know this is the right thing to do. But when you start to have faith, and then you choose to do those things, and then you see the way things play out, and then you begin to realize that when you actually follow that feeling within you, and that guidance, and that intuition that you have, and you see how your life begins to turn out better, then you begin to have faith and think, well, you know, there is something here that I'm not consciously controlling, and I'm not consciously certain how exactly the mechanics of all this work, but I can have faith in it, because I've seen time and time again that when I follow that feeling or that experience, that it leads to really positive outcomes for me. So
yeah, and you can often make decision making more complicated
than
it needs to be if you're left to think about it for an endless amount of time.
Yeah, because how many times have you had a decision to make? You'd kind of chosen one thing, but then you thought, I better consider all the other options. You spend days or weeks thinking through everything, and you end up at the end of the day coming back to the first thing.
Yeah, especially when you didn't know all the facts in the first place.
No.
Or knew very little of the facts. You spend more time trying to think about unknowns, and you can only get so far doing that.
Exactly. And yeah, I mean, I was listening to one person talking at some point. It was basically saying that decision making was spending a lot of time considering different things, and then at the end of that, just making a snap judgment. Anyway, so you could spend a whole week thinking about it. At the end of the day, at one moment, you have to say, well, I'll just choose that anyway.
Yeah. So. And I think to be present and to know why you're responding, or to know how you're responding to certain options, as opposed to responding positively to a certain option and then thinking yourself out of it because of some other distracting event that happened last time. I think it's definitely useful to understand what is coming up in your awareness and where these things are coming from. Well, thanks, Vajan, for your time.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure talking, and thanks for inviting me around to it's your shop, but also a shared space.
Yeah.
And is everyone here associated with this Sri Chinmoy group?
Yeah, so we're really lucky. We've got a beautiful little community based around our meditation center here. So we have a lovely vegetarian restaurant. We have a health food shop. We have a gift shop. And then I run a music store here. So
yeah, which I'm excited to have another look at.
Yeah, come down and have a look.
Let's go have a look at these pretty exotic looking instruments.
All right. Thank you so much. It's my pleasure. And thanks for having me on.
Thanks.
If you're enjoying the Perfect Flow podcast and want more value from it in the future, there are some ways you can support it. The first is to rate or leave a positive review on iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or other platforms where it's available. The second is to share this podcast or specific episodes on social media or with friends. The third is to get involved more directly through the Perfect Flow page on Facebook, where I'm trying to construct a more interactive community. I want Perfect Flow to belong to the listeners, and if you tell me what topics you're most interested in, or even suggest specific guests, I'll do my best to make it happen. This is your opportunity to be part of something that answers your questions and adds value to your life. Another good reason to follow Perfect Flow on Facebook is that I post links to episodes, blog posts, and anything I find useful to this page. It's a great way to follow my training, racing, and learning. Another great way to stay engaged is to subscribe to genebeverage.nz. This way you will get podcasts and blogs emailed to you, avoiding the clutter of Facebook. I don't know where this project will take us, but the reception so far has been positive. Who knows where we might be in a few years?